Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This episode of Groundwire was produced on Algonquin Traditional Territory at CHUO in Ottawa.
I'm your host, Nikki Jean.
And I'm your co-host, Roberto Guevara.
In this episode...
It's a good thing, but it's also a sad thing because it's this big black snake that are bringing all the people together to fight against it. But it's also, like, it's amazing how many of our people are, and all different tribes that are there.
But first, here are the headlines.
A group called the Saskatchewan HIV/AIDS Research Endeavor is demanding that the Saskatchewan provincial government declare a state of emergency over what they call an AIDS crisis, and that they commit to cover all costs of antiviral treatments for HIV-positive people in the province, including on reserve, which is meant to be covered by the federal government, a system that is failing Indigenous communities and only perpetuating the epidemic. Further, an open letter was released on Monday, September 19th, in which 31 of the province's HIV/AIDS physicians demanded a call to action. According to the open letter, the problem is disproportionately affecting Indigenous communities. First Nations and other Indigenous peoples have been hit particularly hard, with more than 70% of the new HIV cases in 2014 being amongst Indigenous peoples. The HIV infection rate in Saskatchewan is 13.8 per 100,000 people, almost double the national average of 7.8 per 100,000. However, this does not account for reserves, where the infection rate is 64 per 100,000. Even that number is misleading, and likely an underestimate, because there is very little testing done on First Nations. When HIV testing is carried out on First Nations, troubling numbers start to emerge. On the Atikokuk First Nation, 60 of 1,700 residents tested positive for HIV, a staggering rate of 3,500 per 100,000 population. At a press conference in Regina on Monday, Denise Berker, Saskatchewan's Deputy Chief Medical Health Officer, responded to the letter by saying that the Saskatchewan government has no mechanism under the province's Health Act to make such a declaration. The Saskatchewan government therefore will not declare a public health emergency over the Indigenous HIV/AIDS epidemic in the province, despite urges from doctors. Further, the provincial government has no public health strategy to deal with HIV/AIDS in the long term, the last one expiring in 2014. The doctors want the government to adopt the 90-90-90 target set out by the UN. It calls for 90% of people who are HIV positive to be diagnosed, 90% of those who are diagnosed to be receiving antiviral therapy, and 90% of those in treatment to have viral levels that are low enough to prevent transmission to others.
On September 16th, the 12th annual Full Moon Memory Walk took place in Thunder Bay on Anishinaabe territory, part of the Robinson-Superior Treaty. Over 100 people gathered in front of City Hall to honor the lives of missing and murdered Indigenous women, Two-Spirit people, and girls. Gladys Reddick, who has been traveling across Turtle Island raising awareness as part of the Walk for Justice, was in Thunder Bay for the Full Moon Memory Walk. She spoke about the national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women, and the importance of centering families.
They finally made that announcement in December that they were going to go through with the inquiry. And they were all screening those families first. I took it upon myself to go up to Ottawa to make sure that families were going to be first. Not going to happen. But as a result of that, there was a few things that happened there that happened while I was there, and I ended up having a heart attack on December the 28th. I had a quadruple bypass surgery, and I started bawling and tearing again for the missing and murdered women on January 4th, because this is not going to go away. We need to figure out how to work collectively so that we can protect not just the Anishinaabe women, but all women. Because women are the life givers of society.
The Full Moon Memory Walk was founded by Sharon Johnson to honor and grieve the loss of her sister Sandra, who was murdered in 1992, and whose case remains unresolved. The sacred walk took place to support the families and friends of those who have gone missing and been murdered, and to continue to raise awareness about the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Participants left City Hall and walked down to the Neebing Floodway, where a sacred fire and feast took place.
A video showing Montreal STM police officers harassing a man in a wheelchair as he crossed the street in Montreal is making rounds on social media. The video posted on Facebook by user Kate Albizi, who explained she and a colleague were out for a coffee break around 11:30 a.m. when they noticed the man, who appeared to be in his 50s, attempt to cross the street at the corner of McGill College and Sherbrooke Street. An officer who identified himself as Officer Lehureux reportedly confronted him for being in the middle of the intersection. He began aggressively pushing him. The man asked him to stop, but the officer kept pushing him. At this point, the man swore at the officer and again asked him to stop pushing him. Lehureux's colleagues stepped in and pushed the man's chair onto the sidewalk. Lehureux said to the man in the wheelchair, "You think you can do whatever you want just because you're in a wheelchair? Yeah, I'm going to give you a fucking ticket. You asked for it." The man did not have a piece of ID on him, prompting the officer to search the man's bag, dumping its contents onto the street.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. You are listening to Groundwire, broadcasting community radio news from coast to coast to coast.
Had to take some weight off, boy, as much as I could. Don't roll through my hood, you bad, bad, not good. Fake niggas, I don't really play that.
You have just heard Weight Off by Kate Renata.
Now it's time for feature stories.
Since April 1st, the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota has organized the Sacred Stone Camp to resist the Dakota Access Pipeline. If built, the crude oil pipeline would pass under the Missouri River twice and run over the Standing Rock Sioux's sacred sites and burial ground. Despite increasing criminalization of protesters and journalists at Standing Rock, the camp continues in defense of the land and Indigenous rights. This special feature comes from reports produced by Co-op Radio in Vancouver and CKUW in Winnipeg.
Here's Gunari and Billy Pierre from Co-op Radio in Vancouver talking to Myron Dewey, who's been taking videos at Standing Rock.
Well, you know, just trying to cover through Indigenous eyes the media and following the protocols as well, when and when not to film, you know, and shutting off the camera and getting the approval. And so I'm also doing a youth media class down here with our youth storytellers and journalists.
Oh, my goodness. So this...
The
stand that people have been taking at in North Dakota has actually influenced youth to pick up the camera and become the media?
Well, I'm coming in from Paiute Shoshone country, and I had some of our relatives down there in Paiute country donate 5 iPads. And I got my camera, and whatever I got, I can share with them. And so we used mobile phones the first day, and now we're just trying to recruit some more youth to go in and do some digital story challenge from the inside out.
That's so great. Wow. There must be people from, like, all nations over there, eh?
You know, this is one of the strongest healing circles I've ever been to. You know, you have black, white, Chicano, all nations. and people coming in and solidarity, and for non-natives to come in and in solidarity, that's part of the healing process.
Wow, that's so amazing. So everyone's united in the struggle for life to protect, I do believe, the Missouri River?
Yes, we can see it right here where I'm up on a hill we call Facebook Hill. It's the only spot where we can get internet and make calls. And you can see the water from here. Teepees are all lined up along it. People are camping and cooking, and right now there's getting ready to be a show with some Native artists coming on, and it's awesome.
And I saw your update, and you were showing us that you were being followed by the police. Are they still following you by any chance? Over here, we suffer from police brutality. We have a high rate of police brutality against minorities, and specifically with and around First Nations people. Is the same thing going on over there in your territory?
Not at all. What's going on here is they're staying out of our way. After we're gone, they do their training. They'll bring in riot gear and all the officers. They'll bring in 10, 15 cars. And yeah, if you look at my post, I'm posting the security, and you can see their certain demeanor, the way they hold their weapons, the way, you know, they conduct themselves. Even when the crowd is you know, pushing in and, you know, let them know that we're protecting the water, they can create composure. But you can tell they're professionals.
Gunari would also hear from Jesus, a Saskatoon-based musician who also took part in the events of Standing Rock.
And I see that there's a lot of action going on. To me, it seems like there's a lot of police presence. And can you tell me more about that from your perspective?
From what I hear, when we came in yesterday, it was a bit tense because one of the brothers, a couple of brothers were actually arrested yesterday at an incident at one of the sites. So basically the camp is not on site. So for a lot of people online who are sharing like information, just know that the camp has nothing to do with the actual pipeline construction site. The camp is where everybody's just kind of gathering and praying and basically taking care of each other and coming up with ways to get through this. You know, there's all types of things that need to be done, you know, just from the kitchen to the firewood to protecting the women in the sweats. There's also sweats going on out here from different tribes. There's marches. We went down by the burial grounds today, and it's crazy. Like, the feeling out here is unreal.
Uh-huh. Exactly. That's what I noticed. I've been watching a lot of how the Native youth there have pulled together to share this news. They've been getting funding for equipment like cameras, microphones, you name it, and now a trailer of all things, right? It's just amazing how it's motivated the people and inspired them to take this a step further.
Yeah, no doubt. Today I've met people from all over North America,
uh-huh.
You know, all over North America, from Montreal, French-speaking natives to Paiute natives to Haida. Some of the Haida sisters just left this morning back to Haida Gwaii. So, I mean, you know, it's really crazy to come into a place that is completely foreign, like, to me. Like, as far as, like, the location and the community and the people,
uh-huh.
It's like, I don't know the place, like, and I've never been here before, but it feels like home.
That was Myron Dewey and Jesus, both from Standing Rock, talking to Gunari from Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Yeah!
CKUW Radio in Winnipeg would also examine the events unfolding in North Dakota.
And we're lucky enough to be joined in the studio by Sadie Phoenix-Lavoie. Tell us about your trip that you took last week down to the Dakotas. What was it like going there?
The Standing Rock Sioux Nation's Cannonball Reservation, where the river sustains so many communities. It was the main drinking source, but there was going to be a pipeline that was going to be constructed to go right through it. So obviously posed a huge risk, high risk. And so the community, you know, banded together and was like, no, we have to resist this. And there was the Indigenous Environmental Network that went on, or had a video, and they were saying that, you know, this is a very peaceful protest. It's done in ceremony where there's women and children and elders and, you know, pipe carriers and Eagle Staff carriers and all these drummers, singers, and they're all here, you know, defending the land. And we were calling on people for solidarity and support. They were saying that the Nakota, Dakota and Lakota, like the three nations, or there's like the second or seven fire councils, so like the seven nations representing that area. They said it was the first time that they ever banded together in alliance in over 100 years. They were saying that the county sheriff went on news and was saying, oh, they're violent and they're threatening people. They have pipe bombs and, you know, like they're assaulting our officers and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, what are you talking about? Like, I literally spent a whole day like getting a bunch of footage and there was not one person being violent. They're being assertive. There's a being resistant against it. There's a difference between that.
Lavoie wasn't the only person CKUW talked to about the Sacred Stone Camp. Here's Josini, also known as Healing Earth Woman, discussing the Standing Rock Sioux's resistance of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Okay. So you were in Standing Rock. You were at the Standing Rock Camp in recent weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about that visit? I mean, how you came to be down there and a little bit about what you saw and experienced there.
It's a good thing, but it's also a sad thing because it's this big black snake that are bringing all the people together to fight against it. But it's also like it's amazing how many of our people are and all different tribes that are there. Mm. Just amazing.
Could you just give our listeners an idea of the tribes that you have encountered while you were there?
Oh my God, just like Hopis. There's Dene, the Navajo, Choctaw, oh my gosh, I can't even name all the tribes. There's so many out there.
The resistance that you talk about from the state and state authorities, I mean, could you talk a bit more, maybe the tactics they're using, underhanded or otherwise?
Well, the first thing that really, when I was down there, the first thing that really, I was uncomfortable was when they started to talk about the National Guard coming in, and it's another form of psychological to put on the people so that, you know, like the actions were already starting to happen, and you know they already had these dogs that attacked the people, and you know it just that psychological warfare that the industry is putting on the people, and there are people who are going to stand up against it no matter what.
Yeah.
They're not going to back down. And to me, that's like it makes me nervous at the same time because it's like, you know, they're the ones that are bringing that violence to the people. Yeah. And it makes me worry about how far are they willing to protect their so-called industry against, yeah, people who love the land.
Well said. Josini, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Appreciate having you on. Let you get on with your day.
Thank you. Support the Red Warrior Camp.
This is Glenn S. from CIVL Radio in Abbotsford, and this piece was produced for Groundwire with audio files from Co-op Radio in Vancouver and CKUW Radio in Winnipeg.
You are listening to Groundwire, airing on your community radio station and available online at groundwirenews.ca. We'll be right back.
Hey!
You just heard Station Powwow by A Tribe Called Red featuring Black Bear from their new album, We Are the Halusa Nation. You are listening to Groundwire, available online at groundwirenews.ca.
Now it's time for our community radio report. Marconi is a name with roots in Montreal and celebrated for contributing to the development of radio technology. A new book argues his contribution was even bigger, one that made Marconi a global figure impacting communication worldwide. Gretchen King from CKUT Radio 90.3 FM spoke with McGill professor Mark Raboy at the book launch of Marconi, The Man Who Networked the World.
He phoned Bertini every day, persisting. Finally, she decided to write to him frankly. Dear Guglielmo, I am too young. I am married to my art. And it was over. In her 1969 Kiss and Tell memoir, she referred to him as my great unforgettable friend, Guglielmo Marconi, but insisted that nothing had happened between them. In 2004, the Milan daily Corriere della Sera remembered her as the actress who said no to Marconi.
So why spend a couple of years in archives around the world, including in the process of learning Italian, to produce this work? What's so special about Marconi?
Okay. Well, first of all, the origin of the work is really that I was doing some research on the early history of radio regulation, and I found that the further back I went, the more I kept tripping over this guy and his company. And I already knew the name Marconi because growing up in Montreal, you know, we had, I mean, Marconi, the Canadian Marconi Company was the most important commercial broadcaster in Montreal, certainly, and one of the most in Canada, so I was aware of him. So I knew this was an important man and company, and actually at first I thought it was going to be more focused on the company. I didn't have the idea of doing a biography until I started doing the research, and I just discovered how fascinating he was. I mean, he touched all of the important moments of the early 20th century. He was a diplomat. He was involved in politics, and including some rather dubious politics, which we can go into if you like. He was wined and dined by kings and prime ministers. He went wherever he went. All doors were open to him, and he had a very interesting and complicated private, personal, and emotional life. So having tripped over this, I just became more and more engrossed in the man himself.
Well, you had mentioned Marconi's contribution to radio, which is well celebrated. Your new book highlights the contribution he made to networking, among others, private and state radio broadcasting around the world. So what contribution, if any, did Marconi make to nonprofit community radio?
Well, first of all, I mean, Marconi really was a precursor of radio as we know it. I mean, in Marconi's mind, I mean, the networking that he was doing was really creating connections. I mean, when he first started out, he called what he was doing wireless telegraphy. Later, he moved on to wireless telephony, which became radio broadcasting. Marconi, when radio appeared on the scene and commercial radio particularly, Marconi thought this was rather frivolous. He thought it would be a passing fad. I mean, to him, the communication was to be two-way. It was to be interactive. It was to have some kind of instrumental purpose beyond simply light entertainment. Now, he took this in some interesting, well, in some controversial directions. I mean, at first, he thought radio could be an instrument of peace. By the end of his life, he was doing international propaganda for Mussolini. You know, as far as not-for-profit community radio is concerned, I don't think that was anywhere on his radar. And certainly, you know, to the extent that he had contact with a not-for-profit sector, it was in the early days of amateur radio, ham radio, and so on, which Marconi actually didn't see the value of. I mean, to him, it was really getting in the way. It was interfering with the business of communication. And having said that, I mean, he still, you know, one of the things that thought wireless telegraphy could be used for was to keep the Italian diaspora in America in contact with the home population for one-tenth the cost of what it was costing to send telegrams by cable. So he had, you know, a rather eclectic mix of interests there.
And can you tell us about the book specifically? So what do Groundwire listeners, CKUT radio listeners have to look forward to in reading your new work?
I hope people seem to be finding it a good read. I mean, the thing is, I didn't intend this to be an academic work. I didn't intend it to be a scholarly work or a political tract. It's really a biography. It's the life of a man who was an important historical figure and who actually had a fascinating life. So I think that's it.
Thank you very much, Professor Mark Raboy, for speaking with Groundwire and CKUT Radio today.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced on traditional Algonquin territory in Ottawa, Ontario at CHUO 89.1 FM.
Headlines this week were written by Lindsay Nixon and Braden Alexander. We thank all the contributors this week, and also Gunarji O'Sullivan, Michael Welsh, Gretchen King, Ome Salma Rahemtula, Glenn S., Carly Forbes, Sarah Bartal, Misham El-Meki, and Jayal.
Music this week was by A Tribe Called Red and K. Trinato.
I have been your host, Nikki Jean.
And your co-host, Roberto Guevara.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca.